All right. Hello, everyone. Jay, I wrote it in the room, but I just wanted to say I agree wholeheartedly. I can also have for years, actually, felt my energy shift and continue to shift through teaching and pal talk several times a week. I think that I teach, what is it? Let's see. I teach 3 times a week now on a normal week and 4 times, I guess, on the first week of the month. And it really makes a difference. So I'm very happy, Jay, that you're here teaching. As Dove mentioned, we are here to look at the 7 steps to awakening. For those of you who don't know, I see a few people in the room who aren't always here. What we're really looking at is my personal journal. I am using the 7 steps to awakening this year for contemplation, and I'm finding now that it also guides me in self-inquiry and realization. And as I just mentioned, it is helpful to come into Pal Talk and teach. Something deepens, something goes on when we teach. And so as a part of my practice, I am teaching from my personal journal twice a week, and you all are doing me a service by allowing me to come and teach. Before we get started, I like to take a moment of silence. So if y'all would join me, we will just be silent for a bit. Amen. All right, so tonight I am beginning with quote number, McAfee has just blocked my PC from making a potentially risky connection. We'll have to look at that later. For now, it says Pal Talk was a part of the connection, so maybe it was one of the little ads that McAfee didn't like. Hopefully you guys can still hear me okay. Would somebody just type in a yes to make sure McAfee still has me speaking? Okay, great, thanks. All right, so what I'm going to do is give you a link to number 149 in my journal, and I will begin by reading quote 149 from the book. That's different than the link I'm giving you. The link I'm giving you is what I wrote after contemplating quote 149 in the book. If anybody is listening on the radio and you want to follow along in the journal, the website is RDA7. That's the digit 7. It's not spelled out. RDA7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. Again, RDA7stepsjournal.wordpress.com. When you get to the blog, you'll notice up on the menu bar there's a step 1. Click on step 1 and then just find the number group that's going to allow you to get to 149. That's where we're starting. And Jamie is, of course, begging to go outside. So let me let her outside and then we'll begin. All right, so I am reading from the book called The 7 Steps to Awakening. I'm reading quote number 149, which is in a section of quotes from another book called The Supreme Yoga. And here's what number 149 says. You have woven the web of your own concepts, and you are caught in it. If you can get rid of all that, attain purity, overcome even the fear of life and death, and thus attain to total equanimity. There we go. Overcome even the fear of life and death, and thus attain to total equanimity, you have achieved the greatest victory. On the other hand, if you cling to this ever-changing phenomenon called the world, you will surely perish in sorrow. My cousin posted a quote on her page. I can't think of the name of the guy. It's not as important as the quote, I suppose. She posted a quote on her page not too long ago that said, I'm not afraid of dying. Before I was born, I was dead for billions and billions of years, and it did not cause me one moment of grief. And I really enjoyed that quote because, someone could argue, whether the quote was completely accurate or not. It's irrelevant. I think the thought within the quote was that there's no reason to cling to this world. It's actually the clinging to this world that causes the grief. It was the guy who wrote, Huckleberry Finn. What was his name? The writer. He's the one that said it. Let me read this quote again from, Mark Twain. Thank you, Jay. Mark Twain. He was the one that said it. Samuel somebody was his real name, wasn't it? Anybody that good on their literature that you remember his real name? Samuel Clemens. There we go. You guys are good. Okay, Samuel Clemens. All right. Let me read this quote again then with Samuel Clemens' idea in mind. And then we'll go to the journal. You have woven the web of your own concepts and are caught in it. If you can get rid of all that, attain purity, overcome even the fear of life and death, and thus attain to total equanimity, you have achieved the greatest victory. On the other hand, if you cling to this ever-changing phenomenon called the world, you will surely perish in sorrow. Looks like Dove is quoting Samuel Clemens again. Says, stories of my death are greatly exaggerated. Yeah. All right, let's go ahead and look at the journal. Number 149. That's the link I gave you. A desire that must be overcome is the desire to live. I'll just say that again. A desire that must be overcome is the desire to live. A preference that must be transcended is the preference for life over death. Without this, I cannot go beyond duality into perfect oneness, because a treasured difference still exists. How shall I overcome this treasured difference? Look at the experience of deep sleep. Is there anything to fear in deep sleep? Don't I love deep sleep? Is there then a real reason for having a preference for life over death? Now, of course, the thought could occur in the mind possibly, but what we are is life. What we are is existence. Death is an illusion. And that is all true. But at the same time, what we're really referring to here is the ego's attachment to life. And this is something that has to be let go, this preference for life over death. Because if the ego's preference for life over death continues, the ego itself won't be let go. I didn't hear all of Jay's teaching, but I know that the section that he covered in A Course in Miracles, the obstacles to peace, and we all know that that third obstacle is the fear of death, right? Again, Samuel Clemens, his quote is absolutely perfect, you know, that he's not afraid of death. Because before he was born, he was dead for billions and billions of years. And it did not cause him one moment's grief. Right? In deep sleep, when there is no dreaming, there is not one moment's grief. And in fact, most of us, I guess I can't say for certain all of us, but most of us really enjoy that experience of deep sleep. That experience of no grief, I'll call it. And it's helpful, at least to me, to look at these ideas, even if these ideas may not be wholly true. Who knows what's wholly true and who's not, what's not. It's helpful to look at these ideas and to realize that there is nothing to fear in death. That death does not cause pain. It's life that causes pain. And the reason it's helpful to look at this is to let go of that ego clinging to life. That fear of death, as the Course puts it. That treasured preference. Because as long as that treasured preference exists, awakening will not occur if we will cling to life in the world as our life. So again, number 149 from the journal. A desire that must be overcome is the desire to live. A preference that must be transcended is the preference for life over death. Without this, I cannot go beyond duality into perfect oneness, because a treasured difference still exists. If you look at that, if you say, I prefer life to death, there's duality in that thought. Right? I cannot go beyond duality into perfect oneness without letting go of this preference for life over death, because a treasured difference still exists. How shall I overcome this treasured difference? Look at the experience of deep sleep. Or look at the Samuel Clemens quote. Is there anything to fear in deep sleep? Don't I love deep sleep? Is there then a real reason for having a preference for life over death? So, interesting little thought. It's the first time this thought had occurred to me. So, it was new for me. If you are in the journal right now, you can just scroll down right underneath the comment area. On the left, you'll see a little number 150. And if you click on that 150, that will take you to the next entry in the journal. Just in case there's someone in the room who's not in the journal but would like to be, I will post the link to number 150 in the room. But before I read from the journal, number 150, I am going to read from page 138 in the Seven Steps to Awakening, quote number 150, which originally comes from a book called The Supreme Yoga. The mind abandons everything when the vision of the Supreme is gained. Hence, one should resolutely renounce everything till the Supreme vision is gained. Not till one renounces everything is self-knowledge gained. When all points of view are abandoned, what remains is the self. I love that last part. When all points of view are abandoned, what remains is the self. I'll read the entire quote one more time. The mind abandons everything when the vision of the Supreme is gained. Hence, one should resolutely renounce everything till the Supreme vision is gained. Not till one renounces everything is self-knowledge gained. When all points of view are abandoned, what remains is the self. All right, so let's look at the journal, number 150. What shall I live as now? the ego or the self. If I can tell the difference, I shall live as self. Why live like an imposter when true self can be discerned and chosen? So what's particularly interesting to me about this quote is, you know, he mentions that when you awaken, there's a natural abandoning of everything else, or a natural renouncing of everything else. But he's saying until that point, until that awakening occurs, he's basically recommending it as a practice to renounce everything. And when some people hear teachings like this, they think that sounds like a sacrifice, to renounce what I want. And I suppose if the feeling is still there that this is what I want, then it, you know, it will feel like a sacrifice, and maybe it's not time for the renouncing to happen yet. I don't know. But my experience is, as we focus on what A Course in Miracles calls our willingness, there's something that awakens in us, which NTI calls our true desire, which is that desire to know thyself. And that desire trumps all other desires in a very honest and sincere way. So that if I seem to want something, what I am able to do is to say, you know, do I truly want that? Do I truly want, for example, the situation to have this specific outcome? Or do I want to awaken? Or do I want to know thyself? And for me, the desire to know thyself is clearly the stronger desire. So if I look at that, then it automatically trumps the other desire, the desire, for example, for a specific outcome, and then I am no longer attached to a specific outcome, which means I can be happy regardless of how the situation plays out, right? Now, with that bit of explanation, look back at the journal entry. What shall I live as now, the ego or the self? If I have this ability to recognize that what I want above all else is to know thyself, then why would I want to live as an ego now? Why would I want to live, you know, deeply attached to all of Regina's preferences and desired outcomes and, you know, desire for control and, you know, fears and, you know, why would I want to live with all of her stuff if I have the honest ability to simply, and by that I do mean simple, to simply renounce those ideas now and go ahead and live as the self now, which means unattached and happy, presently happy, without any desire to control anything, without needing anything to be a certain way. I mean, if someone should ask me, Regina, are you awakened? For me, the honest answer is no. No, no, no. There's still practice happening here, you know? But that does not mean that I need to live with all of the ego pain, as far as I can see. It just doesn't even make sense to me. If I already know how to release the attachments that cause that pain, if I already know how to be happy with being, then why not do that? So to me, it's not a sacrifice to renounce everything now, even though the supreme vision has not yet been gained. That's not a sacrifice, because it was the attachments that actually caused the pain, the wanting things to be a certain way that caused the pain. It's the not renouncing that causes the pain. Therefore, in my perception, it is the not renouncing that is the sacrifice. So what shall I live as now, the ego or the self? If I can tell the difference, I shall live as the self. Why live like an imposter when true self can be discerned and chosen. All right, so if you are in the journal, you can scroll down and look on the left for the little number 151 and click on number 151. I've noticed Barb has entered the room, so I will also post the link in the room for her. And first, I'm going to read from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, quote number 151. At all times, everything is known only by direct experience. Again, at all times, everything is known only by direct experience. All right, let's look at the journal. Direct experience is covered by concepts and thinking. Therefore, self cannot be directly experienced or known, while concepts and thinking are valued and engaged. The second hides the first. And my daily practice right now, my teaching or my sharing is a little behind my daily practice. In my daily practice right now, I think I'm up around quote number 390. And there's a lot of self-inquiry that's going on. And a lot of the self-inquiry started with, an assignment that came from within, an assignment that came from the heart, a self-given assignment. And the assignment was to use honesty beyond human honesty to determine what is absolutely known through direct experience and what is just learned, assumed, or believed. Again, the assignment, self-given, was to use honesty beyond human honesty to determine what is absolutely known through direct experience, right? And to be able to distinguish between that and what is false or what is seemingly experienced. But actually, when looked at carefully, it's discovered that it was learned, assumed, or believed. And when I first started this assignment, the first question that naturally popped into my mind was, well, don't I directly experience the world? Right? When I hit this desk, don't I directly experience this desk? And if direct experience is evidence of what is known or what is true, well, then wouldn't that make this desk true, or wouldn't that make the world true? And, that question just kind of hung out in my mind. I don't know how else to describe it. It just kind of hung out in my mind for a few days, 3 days, 4 days. I don't remember exactly. And then one day when I was sitting down doing my morning contemplation of, my current quotes in the Seven Steps to Awakening, and those contemplations were leading to inquiry, a realization occurred that I do not directly experience the world. That was a belief. What directly experiences the world is the body, the five senses of the body. And that created a shift in me that, I can't quite describe. And so I guess I won't even try. That created a shift in me that I can't quite describe, and it led to additional inquiry, because then the next question became, well, then do I directly experience the body? If the body is what experiences the world, then I can't say that the world is absolutely known through direct experience. But do I directly experience the body? And that question again hung around in my mind for a few days. And then one day, while doing the Seven Steps to Awakening, clarity came that I do not directly experience the body. I really only experience the body through thought and attention. There was this seeing that if there was no thought of body, there would be no experience of body. And the reason there appears to be at least some experience of body all of the time is because there's this belief in body, right? But I could tell from my own direct experience that when I am not focused on the body, you know, for example, if I'm focused on contemplating a quote, in that moment, there's not really a direct experience of the body. In fact, I've had the experience many times of, you know, sitting in my chair for 2 hours or whatever, focused on contemplation, and then when I close the book, you know, when I feel done, I close the book, I suddenly realize I'm hungry and I have to pee. But I didn't realize I was hungry and I had to pee while the attention was elsewhere. So I could tell from looking at this that the body isn't actually directly experienced. It's experienced through thought and through attention. And so then the inquiry started to focus there. And I won't continue this story. You know, the story's in my journal and I'll eventually get to it in the sharing, or people can go ahead and look if they want to go look. You know, probably starting around 350 and reading up to where I am now, which is around 390. But the point is, the quote in the book here says, at all times, everything is known only by direct experience. So why don't we know the self? Because our direct experience of it is covered by concepts and thinking. They are our distraction. They hide the direct experience that is present. And through this self-inquiry, it's kind of like I'm peeling back the layers and I'm seeing this directly for myself. How concepts and thinking create an illusory experience. I've even seen that. The experience that, you know, like the experience of hitting this and feeling this in my hand as I'm hitting it, that's actually an illusory experience. I've seen it. And how the illusory experience then emphasizes the idea of a false self. But if you really look and really pay attention to how many layers are in there, you realize that, well, it's hard, very hard to describe, but you realize it's not a direct experience. It's an illusory experience. And through belief in illusory experience, there's a belief in a false self. And all of that hides the direct experience, the only true direct experience. So direct experience is covered by concepts and thinking. Therefore, self cannot be directly experienced or known while concepts and thinking are valued and engaged. This is encouraging us to give our willingness to not value and engage our own thinking. The second, meaning the thinking, hides the first, meaning the only true direct experience. All right, if you scroll down, just below the comment area, you'll see a little 152. You can click on that, and I will post this in the room as well. And I noticed Dove has put in a quote that fit very well, two quotes that fit very well with the discussion that I just shared, both from A Course in Miracles. The first one, at no time does the body exist. And the second one, to be in the kingdom is merely to focus your full attention on it. Thank you, Dove. It's nice to tie all of these things together. And then he says, I loosed the world from all that I thought it was. All right, we are ready for number 152, and I am going to read from number 152 in the Seven Steps to Awakening first. Here's what it says. Just as a lamp utterly dispels darkness, the knowledge of truth completely uproots concepts and conditioning. Again, just as a lamp utterly dispels darkness, the knowledge of truth completely uproots concepts and conditioning. That's certainly not a new idea to us. Let's look at the journal. Just as the father in the story of the prodigal son came to meet the son when the son decided to abandon his old ways and head home, the light of truth shall complete the journey for us when all value is removed from our old ways and placed with our desire for self. Again, I occasionally hear you know, the debate. It's not always truly in debate form, but I occasionally hear the debate kind of to practice or not to practice. You know, like if the time of your awakening is already set, you know, which is some of the teachings, if you cannot change when you're going to awaken, or you cannot make yourself awaken through practice, why practice? Well, I think for me, the honest answer to that question is, I don't know that I couldn't. You know, I don't know that I couldn't. It's in my heart. It's in my blood to practice. But the idea here is that if you look at the story of the prodigal son, you know, the prodigal son, of course, had left home, right, taken his share of his father's inheritance and squandered it on women and drink. And then he was broke. And then a famine hit the country, and in order to take care of himself, I believe he was working for a farmer, slopping the pigs, but he was still very, very hungry. He got very little for that. And he realized that his father's house, even the servants, were cared for better than him. And so he decided to completely abandon the life that he had, you know, run away to, and to start home. And if you look at the cartoon in your mind right now of this son, you know, he's walking towards home. But he doesn't have to make it all the way home on his own. Because once he starts walking towards home, the father is so overjoyed that the father runs out and joins him. And as soon as the father joins him, everything is given back to him. He's no longer this poor, hungry son. So for me, there is this understanding that that awakening comes through grace. There's not a feeling that I will do good enough at my practice and therefore awaken. That belief is not there. I don't feel like that I have to do good enough, if you know what I mean. And yet, for some reason, there's just a natural walking in that direction. It's like it's time to walk in that direction, and that's what practice is for me. I'm walking in that direction. When Father comes to meet me, grace comes to meet me, it completes the process for me. I don't have to complete it, you see? It completes the process for me. But that doesn't mean I don't want to start walking in that direction. It's kind of like the quote we saw before. If I can live as the self now, why would I live as the ego with all of its suffering? It doesn't even make sense. Why not be the unattached, happy being now, even if, you know, awakeness is not complete? Is there a rule somewhere that says we have to suffer until awakening is complete? I haven't seen that anywhere. And it seems to me, the more I become the self, the more I, you know, live as the self. I would say imitate, but some people may misunderstand the word imitate, but it does tell us in the Bible to imitate God. But the more I make the choices that are self-like choices rather than ego-like choices, the happier I am now, and that's what we call practice, or that's what I call practice. So although the lamp will utterly dispel the darkness, and it's not my job to somehow make the darkness go away, grace does that, I still want to start walking in that direction now. And so that's what I'm doing. It's quite simple as far as I can see. Yeah, Lynn has written, the more I practice, the less I suffer. Exactly. And Barb used Jesus' words, the happy learner. Okay, let's scroll down, and just below the comment area, you'll see a number 153. You can click on that. And we've had one or two new people join the room, so I will also post this link to number 153 in the room. First, I will read quote number 153 from the book, The Seven Steps to Awakening, and here it is. If you conceptualize this teaching for your intellectual entertainment. And do not let it act in your life. You will stumble and fall like a blind man. And I think, you know, we know what's being talked about here. You know, like, you know, the ability to go and, you know, sit in course groups and know the course really well and, you know, be very smart about it. But yet, as soon as something happens in our own life, we're back to blaming. Back to wanting things a certain way. Back to trying to control, right? If you conceptualize this teaching for your intellectual entertainment and do not let it act in your life, you will stumble and fall like a blind man. All right, let's look at 153 in the journal. Remember, this is my personal journal. This is not really considered a teaching. It's just me doing my work the way I feel guided to this year, right now. So here's what number 153 says. Every word written in this journal is for practice. Without the follow-through of practice, the words are completely meaningless. Again, that's me writing to me. I'm not asking anyone else to become followers of my personal journal. But everything that is being written in this journal is for me. And to have the fun, because for me it is fun to sit in my morning contemplation. This is not something I dread. This is something I love. To have the fun of sitting in the contemplation for the 2 hours or whatever every morning, but then to walk away and totally forget it, that is not what reduces pain and suffering. What reduces pain and suffering is then taking what came in that fun 2 hours of contemplation and practicing it when whatever happens in my life happens. And actually, I've been doing this, as you know, most of you know, long before we ever got to the 7 steps. You know, my practice began with A Course in Miracles back in 2004. And then there was the practice of NTI. And then the practice of both together in the relationship with Laurent. And then the practice of the teachings of Inner Ramana. And now the 7 steps to awakening is coming, right? But the practice has been there all along. And as a result, there's great joy here already. I'm not just beginning to experience great joy because I'm not just beginning to practice. But if I had spent all of those years learning the teachings in the magnificent books that I studied and becoming an expert at the teachings of the magnificent books I studied or the magnificent books I wrote, but did not practice it, then I would still be hoping for that joy. I would still be saying, okay, I got to start now because the joy hasn't happened yet. All these years have gone by and I'm still, you know, upset that Jamie's whining while I'm teaching. I don't know if you guys heard her. She was whining for half an hour. But instead, you know, what happens for me is that, you know, things that we could call major events occur, major opportunities for upset occur, and I'm not upset. You know, the one that I've talked about a lot this year was when the septic blew up in the basement. But recently, I realized I had made a serious mistake on my taxes 2 years in a row. You know, it could appear to be illegal. I mean, it is illegal. It could appear to be fraud, but it was just, you know, it was actually just being stupid. But I suddenly realized that I had made this mistake 2 years in a row, and I went and amended my taxes and paid the government back about $2,400. I still have to wait to hear what penalties and interest there may be. And of course, you never know when you do something like this, there may be an audit, right? I did all of this without any upset or fear of any type. It was just noticing the mistake had occurred, realizing what needed to be done, and then doing it. And there was no change of joy. That's what practice does. So I guess we're talking, you know, a lot kind of indirectly about what I called earlier the debate to practice or not to practice. But, you know, obviously I'm for practice. Again, I think the debate comes from what might be a fact. You know, I don't know for a fact. But it might be a fact that you do not awaken through practice. You only awaken through grace. Many people that say they are awakened say that. They say it wasn't the practice, it was the grace. And that may be true. And in the end, when, you know, final awakening happens here, I may say, ah, you know what? It wasn't the practice, it was the grace. I may say, you know, it wasn't the practice, guys. But the practice is making me happier now. The practice is making me joyous now. And like I said, where is the rule that says we have to suffer until the light comes on? I have not seen that rule. Nor do I choose to make it up and then follow it. So again, this is me writing to me. Every word written in this journal is for practice. Without the follow-through of practice, the words are completely meaningless. All right. So let's scroll down then and click on number 154. I swear, I think I smell food, but I don't know why I would. Usually Jasmine nor Danielle cook on Sunday nights. But maybe I'm just hallucinating. I feel like I smell food. Okay, number 154 then in the book says, "He in whom all concepts and habitual tendencies have ceased has overcome all mental conditioning and bondage." And again, notice he's saying, again, he in whom all concepts and habitual tendencies have ceased. So the light has come on. Grace has occurred, right? He in whom all concepts and habitual tendencies have ceased has overcome all mental conditioning and bondage. So he's free, right? Okay, let's read number 154 from the journal. Ah, here we go. More with the practice. It's funny how sometimes we see themes in the sharing when, you know, well, it's kind of random on where I stop and where I start. Here we go. Not to practice is to continue old habits. Those habits are ego maintenance tendencies. How can maintaining ego be helpful if the purpose is to become egoless? Practice is a helpful choice. True practice uproots unseen tendencies and then abandons or reverses them so that immediately or over time, old ego maintenance habits are undone and there is nothing to maintain the idea of a false self. Hi, Jasmine. So, it's interesting, you know, that what I wrote here was that, practice, and this is absolutely true based on my experience, practice uproots unseen tendencies. You know, you start to see ego habits that you have, that you've kind of blindly followed before, that you didn't see before. So of course you followed them, you weren't aware of them. So in that way it's perfectly natural. But what happens with true spiritual practice is you start to see them. My experience, the way it's happening for me, kind of one at a time over several years, like as, you know, one thing shows up and then another thing shows up. And it's like I'm just continually seeing these ego tendencies. And then what happens when I see an ego tendency is one of two things happens. Either it is seen so clearly that this is a tendency that doesn't make sense and that I do not want, that I'm able to drop it immediately on the spot. It's completely healed immediately on the spot. Or it's something that's a little deeper. Maybe I'm still not so sure that I would, you know, be okay without it. Somehow maybe I believe it protects me or keeps me safe. And so I have to keep throwing willingness at it. I'm willing to let go of this. I'm willing to let go of this. And over time, it seems to disappear. I've had the experience of both. Things that are immediately seen and released and things that take, you know, a little bit of time. But through the process of both, and now in my case over, you know, a small number of years, a lot of ego maintenance habits are completely undone. They're completely gone already without awakening. Isn't that wonderful? Who said you have to awaken to be free of habits that cause you pain? You don't. At least as far as I can tell, you don't. And so as a result, again, I'm so happy, truly happy, honestly happy, sincerely happy. Life can be whatever life is going to be, and that's fine with me. But it's through the process of allowing these ego maintenance habits to be seen, and then either immediately or over time, released, let go, no longer a part of this personality's makeup. Doesn't mean the personality's not here. The part of the personality makeup is being undone so that I am no longer affected by those things. I no longer act or react in the ways I used to. You know, it's funny because I'm doing the course workbook this year, and according to the calendar. And in the last week, we've been focused on the fact that our function is joy, that our function is happiness. And of course, a part of that was Lesson 101, God's will for me is perfect happiness. But practice is what achieves that function. The happiness is so covered up by all of the ego maintenance tendencies, all of the unseen tendencies, unconscious beliefs, some people may call them, that if we don't truly practice, we also don't truly gain the experience of joy. We just stay right where we're at because the ego maintenance tendencies are the same, right? Okay, so not to practice is to continue old habits. Those habits are ego maintenance tendencies. How can maintaining ego be helpful if the purpose is to become egoless? Practice is a helpful choice. True practice uproots unseen tendencies and then abandons or reverses them so that immediately or over time, old ego maintenance habits are undone, and there is nothing to maintain the idea of a false self. All right, let's scroll down and click on number 155 on the left. I will also post this link in the room. And I will read number 155 from the Seven Steps to Awakening. Here it is. Since the ignorant are bound fast to their own false notions, neither the transiency of the world nor the hard blow they suffer in their life is able to awaken them. That's the power of attachment. You know, if you're really attached to the way you think, if you really believe your way of thinking is right, even if you are one of the greatest sufferers in the world, your suffering will not awaken you. Because you have to be willing to let go of the idea that you're right about the way you see, about the way you think. Of course, this is reminiscent of the Course's quote, "Would you rather be right or happy?" Right? Since the ignorant are bound fast to their own false notions, neither the transiency of the world nor the hard blow they suffer in their life is able to awaken them. All right, let's look at number 155 in the journal. Awakening requires an opening. One who feels sure about everything cannot be awakened. The illusion accompanied by certainty is like a steel door that keeps awakening locked firmly outside. The door is opened through not knowing. The greater the degree of not knowing, the wider the door swings open. Be willing to not know anything. Let this willingness help you see what you think you know about the world, yourself, and spirituality. See every idea of certainty, every idea of I know, as an obstacle to full realization. Let go of every idea of I know and step willingly into complete uncertainty. I don't remember what I was talking about earlier in this hour, but I remember saying something that's a fairly common teaching. And I also said, you know, I don't know that for a fact, but that's the teaching, or something like that, right? I didn't say this is the way it is. Right? In fact, I think it seems like I did that a couple of times. There's a reason for that. You know, it really is a great error that we make to listen to a teacher or read a book like A Course in Miracles or anything else. Whoops, hello, Janie. I just got ran into directly. Hello, my love. Did you want some attention? She does want some attention. Hello. And without any direct experience of that teaching, to take it on as a fact. That's an error. It's taking a belief, but saying we know that that belief is a fact. And many teachings are actually just pointers. They're not even ultimately true. So we're taking something that's not ultimately true. I think one of the things I mentioned was the idea that the date and time of your awakening is already known. I said there are some teachings like that. You know, I don't know, but there are some teachings that say that. But I don't know that. So why would I read in a book that the date and time of your awakening is already known and then hold to that as if that is a factual idea and I know? And then when someone else comes along with some other theory, I disagree with them and I say, you're wrong, boy. I know. I read it in this book, this authority. The date and time of your awakening is already, you know, and you know what? There's an upset in me as I'm trying to prove to this person how right I am. Why would I do that when the fact of the matter is, and this is the fact, is that I don't know. I just read that somewhere. I don't know. How in the hell am I supposed to know if the date and the time of my awakening is set? I don't know. I know that there is a teaching that says that. I do know that, but I don't know that it's true. We take on so many things that we don't know as if we know. And all of this not knowing that we take on as knowing keeps us very firm and sure of ourself. But that self that we're very firm and sure about is the false self. In order for awakening to occur, we have to be willing to say, you know, I don't know these things. We can say, you know, so-and-so teaches, this book says, you know, I've read that. You know, that was helpful in my mind because it helped me to release this. But I don't know. I don't know. In fact, so far, the only thing through my inquiry that I have been able to confirm that I know, there's only one thing. The only thing that I confirm, that I can confirm that I know, is that there's existence here. I'm not even going to use the word I exist, because I don't want that I to be misinterpreted for Regina, because actually the inquiry has shown that that's not true. But there is existence here. There is existence present. There's existence being now. That's the only thing I've been able to confirm. Anything else that I thought was true, as I really look at it with inquiry, I find I can't actually confirm that. I can't, another thing that people debate is whether the world is actually real or not. I mean, you could say whether the world is here or not. People debate this based on what they've read in books. You know, some people say it's just your perception of the world that's false, but the world itself is real. And other people say, oh, no, 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 and they debate. Well, I can't say for a fact. What I can say for a fact is that through inquiry, I have found I cannot confirm that the world is here. There's enough, you could call it reasonable doubt, that has shown up in my own mind, through my own direct inquiry, that I cannot confirm that the world is here. So that's an opening, you see? That's an opening. That's an I don't know. You know, A Course in Miracles, as Dove mentioned earlier, A Course in Miracles says the body has never existed. I can adopt that as a belief. This body has never existed. But just because I read it in a book, does that mean I know it? Now, what I have found through my own inquiry is, again, reasonable doubt that it exists. True, honest, reasonable doubt. But all that's taken me to is what you could call an unknowing, an opening. The only thing that I've been able to confirm and say, I know, this cannot, there's no reasonable doubt here, is that existence is present. I haven't found any reasonable doubt about that. Everything else I have found, reasonable doubt. But that only creates opening. So awakening requires an opening. One who feels sure about everything cannot be awakened. The illusion accompanied by certainty is like a steel door that keeps awakening locked firmly outside. The door is open through not knowing. The greater the degree of not knowing, the wider the door swings open. Be willing to not know anything. Let this willingness help you see what you think you know about the world, yourself, and spirituality. See, every idea of certainty, every idea of I know, as an obstacle to full realization. Let go of every idea of I know and step willingly into complete uncertainty. And that's it for me. I will be back tomorrow. Noon my time, which is 2 p.m. Eastern time. And we'll continue beginning with number 156. Yeah, and as Barb has written, in reasonable doubt is enough to prevent a guilty verdict. All right, bye.